Next speaker and our last speaker of the day is another School of Environment honor student, Mr. Stefan Crampton, who is finishing his Bachelor of Arts in Sciences, a combined degree at McGill, with a minor concentration in International Development Studies. He is supervised by Professor Tom Meredith. He'll be speaking about his work concerning conflicts between conservation and development in Panama.
All right, so thank you very much for the nice introduction. So today I'll be talking to you guys a little bit about the research that I chose to do for my honors thesis, which is essentially looking at the apparent dichotomy that seems to exist between conservation and local livelihoods in protected areas. And specifically, I chose to analyze the case of the Chagres National Park. I was there last year on the Panama Field Study semester. So first of all, in order to understand why the park was created, we have to look at the relationship and importance between the Chagres River Basin and the Panamanian economy. So as many of you may know, the Panama Canal is one of the most famous canals in the world. It's a major global trading route. It attracts a lot of investment and business to the country. And simply through its operation, it produces 6% of national GDP. So already we see that there's a really big importance here for the Panama Canal and the economy. Now, in order for the Panama Canal to operate, it needs huge amounts of freshwater inputs, which it gets from the surrounding watershed. 64% of the inputs actually come directly from the Chagres River. So now we have a link between the river, the watershed, and the economy. Secondly, the river actually provides potable drinking water for 50% of the population of the country, about 1.5 million people. And finally, the Chagres River Basin is located in a biodiversity hotspot region. So for these reasons, in 1984, they created the park. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a pointer here, but the park is located approximately in the middle of the country there. Now, if you look on the bottom figure, that's a map of the park. Now, you can see in dark green, it's primary forest, so untouched land. However, unfortunately, there's a lot of light green, which is secondary forests, and yellow, which is agricultural land either used for cultivation or livestock. So there are a lot of human presences in the park. Finally, red just represents populated regions. So the park was populated in the 1950s. Now, in Panama, there's a system of informal land tenure, which means that in order to claim land as yours, all you have to do is add value to the land, which means you deforest it and you grow crops on it, and it's considered to be yours. People do it all over Panama, and it was done here. Now, in the park, there's been a dramatic growth in population. In the last census that we have, which was in the year 2000, we saw that the population actually grew by about 13%. It's at about 2,700 people now. Their livelihood activities are mainly subsistence agriculture and cattle ranching. Now, unfortunately, 87% of them live in extreme poverty. So their livelihood activities lead to deforestation, which causes habitat fragmentation, biodiversity loss, and along with overgrazing, it leads to soil erosion and the sedimentation of rivers, which is a direct threat to the hydrological regime of the area and thus to the Panamanian Canal and thus to the economy. So in this context then, authorities decided to implement strict conservation policies, really a command and control approach. Livelihood activities that they've been doing for their entire lives have all of a sudden become prohibited without their inputs or participation. So deforestation, hunting, and use of natural resources is now not allowed anymore. This has had a huge impact on their livelihoods because campesinos, which is a Spanish term for peasant or local farmers, they're dependent on fuel wood and construction materials from the forest as well as land for cultivation. And they actually depend largely on bushmeat for a source of protein. So in this situation, their livelihoods have been severely impacted by these policies. So this leads me to my research question, which is how do current conservation policies in Chagres National Park create social justice issues, and how do we address these while still meeting our conservation goals? So my objectives were to assess the effectiveness of current conservation policies evaluate its effects on local livelihoods, and determining whether establishing land tenure rights and payment for environmental services could resolve these social justice impediments while enhancing conservation goals. Now, I'd just like to mention that I chose to look at land tenure rights and PES because this was what the majority of the locals said could be a good solution for them. So that's why I chose to look at that. So my methodology, I did 25 semi-structured interviews with local farmers in the southeastern section of the park from January to April of last year. And I did. I also had informal discussions with park residents, and I did a literature review. And that's actually me there doing my work in the field. So what did I find? What were my results? So I found that deforestation was largely halted and that new colonization was halted. However, 40% of farmers still hunted either to protect their crops or livestock from animal predation or to supplement their diet. And we actually found a statistical correlation between hunting activities and the distance from the ranger station. And this here was a hunter that I actually talked to. So my analysis is that park authorities are really only partly effective at enforcing their policies. And the undesirable land uses on already colonized land continues. And really, this is all compounded by food insecurity and underlying extreme rural poverty, which really drives the dependence on the extraction of forest resources. And this is furthermore added by isolation, poor infrastructure, difficult access to markets, and weak institutional frameworks. So that there's the social economic situation of the park. Now, land tenure. So that's my first category of intervention. So many conservation organizations in the last few years have realized that land tenure is really important in order to achieve conservation in protected areas. Now, the Nature Conservancy said here that when land tenure is made secure, people make better decisions about land and resource use with a longer-term perspective. Now, this is because there's a strong positive correlation between land tenure rights and a more sustainable use of the land. Because when you're in a situation of tenure insecurity, you tend to want to maximize the returns from your land because you don't know when you're going to be kicked off of it, right? So your time horizons are really short, and you want to maximize the productivity from the land today because you don't know when you're going to get kicked off. So by giving them land tenure, there's actually been a lot of case studies that have shown that farmers tend to adopt more sustainable uses of the land. Now, the second quote here is by the USAID Panama program. Now, USAID is an American aid organization, and it's actually invested significant financial resources in conservation in Panama. And one of its conclusions in its assessments of its projects was that communities should be given long-term tenure over forest lands, along with training in forest management planning and skills in processing and marketing forest products. This will result in an increase in individual and community income while creating an incentive to protect the watershed. Now, this quote really shows that what we really want to achieve is community participation in the protection process. By giving communities an incentive to protect the watershed, it will likely be more effective at achieving our conservation goals while enhancing their well-being. So establishing property rights would reduce community tensions and furthermore improve dialogue. And community participation and engagement in decision-making process is vital if real conservation is ever to occur. Now, my second category of intervention that I chose to look at were payment for environmental services. Now, what are environmental services? Well, they're just benefits that people obtain from ecosystems. So payment for environmental services would thus be a voluntary transaction where the provision of an environmental service is purchased from a buyer, by a buyer from a service provider. So in the case of the Chagres National Park, well, the service provided is really a hydrological service as well as a biodiversity conservation service. So potential buyers could be the Canal Authority, the government, or even conservation authorities or NGOs. And the service providers, at the end of the day, are those people who manage the land. So thus, campesinos. Now, I believe that payment for environmental services has the potential to be a win-win situation, because if ecosystem services are protected through this financial market incentive, The conservationists are happy because biodiversity is protected, and the Canal Authority is happy because there's less sedimentation in the watershed. Now, this extra capital for the campesinos can actually be either viewed as compensation for restriction of their livelihood activities, or just extra capital in order to pursue perhaps alternate livelihood activities. Now, this is a relatively new idea, but it has been implemented with relative measures of success in Bolivia, Costa Rica, and Mexico. Now, a final note on PES is that it really does need to be voluntary. It really does require that rights over land and resource use are clarified, and it needs state and community engagement for it to work. And finally, it does need to be targeted. You can't just, you know, give payments to everybody, because you really need, in a situation of really limited resources, you need to maximize your utility while minimizing your cost. So in conclusion then, I have realized that conservation policies in Chagres National Park have led to large social costs. Their livelihood activities have been compromised, and the human well-being has been diminished, and all of this with conservation goals having only partly been met. So through tenure rights, increased community participation, and payment for environmental services schemes, they do promise to provide a solution to better protect the park while improving well-being. But we do have to remember here that conservation cannot solve poverty, but it can help to prevent and reduce it by maintaining ecosystem services and supporting livelihoods. So I would just like to thank my supervisor, Tom Meredith, who's actually in Panama right now. Also, I'd like to thank the NGO Somaspa, who I worked with while I was in Chagres, as well as to all the campesinos who I worked with while in the park. And now I'd like to take any questions or comments. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Stefan? Yes, we do.
Sorry. So I remember when you were in Panama with your group doing this type of research, you would walk for hours and hours between each home and having to drive really far into the forests or travel by horse to get to these places. So the monetary compensation you're saying with the PES, if these people are living so far from places where they can purchase, I don't know, food or other sources that they need, have you taken that into consideration, like how far they have to travel, or even if they can get to these places to buy food or do other things with their money?
Okay, well, that's actually a very good point. There is very limited infrastructure in the park. Now, there are, you know, dirt roads that you can access the park in through ATVs or jeeps, et cetera, et cetera. You know, after that, you really got to use horses to get into the park. So you're right that in terms of achieving the payment per se, transaction costs may be high. However, I'd like to point out that there is a lot of ranger presence in the park. The Canal Authority is very present in the park. They have monitoring stations for rivers in the park. They fly in these canal monitoring authorities to, by helicopter into the park. So with all of these people coming in, I think that giving the people the payment should not be an issue. As to what they could do with the extra capital, as you said, because they're far away from markets, that's definitely something to take into consideration when designing it. But it's a possibility. And it's worked in other regions, and if properly implemented, I hope that it could work here.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Now, just to remind people, tomorrow's session will consist of a panel discussion from 9 a.m. to 11. We've invited four environmental scientists with policy experience to share their ideas and insight on how to bridge the gap between, the obvious gap between environmental science and policy, and I should actually say action. That'll be tomorrow, and I expect that to be rather lively. There'll be questions. They'll discuss it with each other, and there'll be questions from the audience. Right now, take advantage of there's a reception. I don't know if it's outside or not, and there'll be a poster session. You can examine some other aspects of research done at McGill and locally. Tomorrow, we will present awards for best posters, and that'll be at the end of the panel discussion. Thank you very much.